Good morning. Could you be unconsciously racist? A new study by researchers at the University of Hawaii, the University of North Carolina, and Rutgers University says you just might be. We'll talk with lead author, UH Law School professor Justin Levinson.
And 10-year-old fifth grader Odysseus Tafuna puts child labor in China into perspective after his district-level win in a History Day competition. Plus, we'll hear from an avid cyclist about the future of biking in Hawaii after the national focus on Bike to Work Week is over. And later in the hour, we'll bring you a preview of the Combined Forces Band concert.
That's The Conversation for Thursday, May 15th. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, I've seen a lot of progress in this country over my lifetime about how it handles racism, but there's a ways to go.
Evidently, and that's going to be the subject of our first conversation this morning. You may remember that the last time we talked with him, UH Law Professor Justin Levinson was working on a study asking a sensitive question. Are people unconsciously racist? That question has implications for many types of behavior, but in this case, especially how jurors react in cases where the death penalty could be the outcome. The study was researched in conjunction with the University of North Carolina and Rutgers University. Justin Levinson is the lead author, and he's here now in studio with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Seeing the study complete, as we were talking about it when you were first starting it, now we actually look at the study. It seems that you proved what you kind of set out to see, that in fact we have this unconscious bias and that it affects us in lots of different ways, but especially when you're talking about how people value human life in the case of a death penalty jury.
Right. Well, going into this study, we did know that what we call implicit biases or unconscious biases are quite powerful and prevalent. What we didn't know is what would happen in this particular study. And in this study, we tried to expand the discussion to look at whether people unconsciously valued white lives as being worth more than black lives, which is obviously a pretty intense topic.
You looked at the top states where we have the death penalty, what, six of the seven of them?
Right, exactly.
And that includes, well, you can have the list there.
Yeah, so we looked at Alabama, Arizona, California, Oklahoma, Florida, and Texas.
So none of these were regionally localized to any particular part of the country. You simply took them based on the death penalty issue.
Exactly.
But when we start to look at who has more, you know, value in someone's eyes as they sit on a jury, how did you test that specifically?
Right. So when you ask the question, do people value one life as being worth more than another, it's very difficult to test. So what we set out to do was create a method that captured it without, perhaps even without people's awareness. And that involves a category sorting task where people see words and pictures flash on their computer screen. And they're required to sort words and pictures. So for example, we tell them to sort together pictures of Caucasian faces with value-related words, such as worthwhile, worthy, value, valuable. And we tell them to sort together pictures of African-American faces with worthless type words. So drain, expendable, worthless, for example. And then we switch the categories. So they have to sort black with worth and white with worthless. And we measure how fast they can do it. And basically what we find is that people cannot categorize black and worth as fast as they can categorize white with worth.
So if I'm sitting there, if you were giving me this test, I would be looking at a screen.
Yes.
And seeing pictures of either black people or white people flashing on it, and then be told to sort based upon whichever category you would give me, either worth or worthless.
Exactly.
What was the time differential?
Well, so we measure this in milliseconds, right? And when you do it in milliseconds, a 50 to 100 millisecond difference is actually quite substantial. And so those are the kind of differences we found. I mean, statistically, you do a lot of conversions, and there are a lot of things you have to do with the data. But we found moderate to strong biases, not just in value of life stereotypes, but also in more traditional stereotypes that we tested also.
Specifically what?
So, for example, concepts of lazy, hostile, dangerous, compared to things like calm and trustworthy.
Milliseconds making differences in how someone judges whether a life is valuable or worthless when it comes to having to pass judgment on someone. What does that correlate toward when you look at how many, or were you able to look at how many people were judged as being worthless in a death penalty case versus those who were seen as being worthwhile simply because of the color of their skin?
Well, it's hard to quantify the effect over a huge population like all the death penalty cases. We did run it in conjunction with a study where people had to make decisions, and we did find that in certain circumstances it actually predicts. I think the bigger thing for us is that this type of research has already been established to predict decision making. So medical decision making, whether somebody gets a certain drug or not, job hiring decisions, whether someone is asked to give an interview for a job or not invited to give an interview. So economic allocation, so giving money to student organizations or charities, all those things have actually been connected to these reaction time-based unconscious biases.
What's not part of the study, though, is any discussion about Native Hawaiians. That's not in it, even though sometimes Native Hawaiian folks will say, I go someplace else and they think I'm black or not, based upon the shade of skin. Anything that you tend to do with, or you intend to do with this study, to more localize it to Hawaii?
Yeah, so this study, we had a national focus because, well, until now, we really didn't have to deal with the death penalty in Hawaii at all. So we were focused on death penalty states and the statistics as to who's on death row, which is really shocking when you look at the numbers. In Hawaii, we do have the racial bias issue with black and white in Hawaii. I should just say that when I run these types of studies in Hawaii, I get the same results. With regard to Native Hawaiians, we don't have as much data. I did run, for example, skin tone study in Hawaii, where we tested whether showing people a photo of a perpetrator with slightly different skin tone affects the way evidence in a trial is evaluated. And it absolutely showed that.
And that was skin tone based on a forearm only, not
exactly. Yeah, so we had a masked perpetrator in that study. And so all we did was manipulate the only skin that was showing, and we asked people to rate the evidence that we showed them. We gave everybody the same evidence, and people who had seen for only 3 seconds a photograph of a darker-skinned perpetrator thought the evidence tended to indicate more guilt.
We do know, though, that disproportionately Native Hawaiian youth and adults wind up incarcerated. So how do you move the study from the death penalty issue to talking about how we judge people when we decide to incarcerate them?
Well, the methods can be transferred to Hawaii, and that's something I have a lot of students interested in, and I have colleagues that are interested in that issue. So we're beginning to work on it. But the data is not there yet. Having said that, the data on the criminal justice system is there, and you had the OHA report showing a lot of that, and parole decisions. To me, the place to investigate is the discretion points within the system, right? When do police have discretion? When do prosecutors have discretion? When do judges have discretion? When do parole officers have discretion? And that's where you see these implicit biases, specifically regarding to criminality and character issues, come into play. So if a parole officer sees somebody and they have associations with laziness, for example, or they have associations with drug user or violence, those things can actually override the true character of the person they're looking at.
So what do we do if we know that we have implicit biases and we still are trying to operate as if we can be objective people in certain ways? How is there any way of being able to overcome that or to compensate for it?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing to do is actually to explore this and recognize it, right? We have to look within and say, we may be egalitarian people. When I walk down the street, I don't think that I'm going to cross the street differently based upon who's on the other side. Or I'm not going to remember when to lock my car doors based on who I see crossing the street in front of me, right? We have to acknowledge that those things operate within each of us. And then we have to take some kind of responsibility for it. It is automatic. It is part of how humans work. but there are harmful consequences. Once we've done that, we can learn about it, and there are techniques people can practice to actually overcome this, such as stereotype replacement.
And we'll talk about that another time. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks
and
for having me.
Glad your study was finished.
I appreciate it.
Justin Levinson is professor of law and founding director of the Culture and Jury Project at the University of Hawaii's William S. Richardson School of Law. His research focuses on how human minds operate in the legal context, including in jury selection, decision-making, and biases. He's the editor of the book Implicit Racial Bias Across the Law. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, now at 8:15. Taking a look at what's coming up, a Ka'ava fifth grader with a flair for historical research. But first, the backyard quiz.
If you live in Hawaii, you know that where we live, there are rainbows, and usually you have to look up to spot them. But did you know there are others with roots? Hawaii hosts a species of trees known commonly as rainbow eucalyptus. And in the scientific world, the trees are referred to as Eucalyptus deglupta, and they are easily identified by their multi-hued, rainbow-colored bark. Later, it darkens to shades of blue, purple, yellow, orange, and maroon. The final result looks like a mixture of all the colors, and that's what gives the trees their rainbow-like appearance. For today's backyard quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the alternate nickname for the rainbow eucalyptus tree. Post your answer on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation if you know, or wait for the answer in the next half hour. Local stories are more rewarding to report than the ones about exceptional accomplishment from young students in our schools. The kids are a source of pride to their peers, their parents, and their teachers, and this year's History Day competitions have produced a bumper crop of exceptional work. Odysseus Tafuna is one of many who did really well this year, and his story stands out for a couple of reasons. Odysseus is 10 years old. He and his friend Ha'aheo Carter captured first place at the district level for their age group with an exhibit called Child Labor in China. It's a subject that's close to his heart, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Odysseus.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. This subject meant something to you, didn't it? Child labor in another part of the world.
Yeah, it did.
Why was it important to you to sort of track down the history here?
Well, because, I'm Chinese, and I'm thinking that probably one of my ancestors were a child labor worker, or they were, yeah.
Possibly, yeah, because there are so many. Is there any kind of number of how many kids are involved in child labor in that country?
No, we don't really know, because there's, a really lot of kids working.
Was it hard to find out the information that you found out?
I think so. Wait, yeah, kind of.
Well, tell me about, you created a poster, right? You and Ha'aheo created a poster. What's on the poster?
There's a cycle and three quotes from these people, like Kofi Annan and...
The UN,
And also, there's a line, a period, like a time period. There's a timeline.
Timeline, yeah. What's on that?
There's four history eras, I think.
Uh huh.
And,
Well, does it, and so the whole thing of child labor there goes back a long way?
Yeah, really long. Really, really long ago.
And it continues to this day. Did you tell me earlier when we talked about it, did you say that you thought it might even be increasing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because people like the employers of some companies who allow child labor, they want to maximize their profit and they want more money, so they'll hire children to do work so they don't have to really pay them much, like adults.
Are there are some of those products that we might get here in America? Some
yes.
of the things that those the children make?
Yeah.
What kinds of things?
Like, shoes, slippers, computer, Apple computers, well, some. Xboxes, PS4.
Stuff that you make in a,
yeah.
in a factory, huh? What's the work like for these kids?
Dangerous and hazardous.
Uh-huh.
And,
So they got long hours and not very
yeah.
good safety conditions,
they
that kind
really
of thing.
They don't really go to sleep, and they work, like, a whole week. They don't stop because they want to, like, work to help their family. And they think by working, they will get a lot of money and stuff.
So you being a young person yourself, when you did this research, when you found out about this stuff, did you find yourself thinking, you know, if I lived in this country, that could be me?
Yeah.
Was that
if,
kind of...
If our family was poor. If.
But was that kind of a scary thought?
Yeah. Because I would have to go working in some dangerous factory.
Well, you know, whenever you get into a subject like this that's troubling, you know, people are suffering, what kind of solutions do you think there are out there?
I don't really know. I only, like,
Because, you know, I mean, that's a question people are going to ask, right? What can we do about this? And it does seem, if it's a problem that's growing, that's kind of scary, huh?
Because it hasn't really stopped. And the Chinese government isn't really enforcing their law, so I don't really know. Kinda.
Well, you know, one of the things, Odysseus, I think, is that by letting people know about this, do you think that's going to help?
Hmm.
Kind of creating
yeah.
some public awareness?
Or they'll probably boycott it or something. I don't know.
It but is hard yeah. to know what to do, though, yeah, when a problem
Cause
is
Because it affects everyone if we do, like, something. If we stop buying from them. Then it'll affect us in a way because we buy a lot of their things.
You mean we'd have to pay higher
yeah.
prices for some things?
We have to work harder.
Well, that might be something to do, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You've done history day projects before. Is that something?
Oh no, this is my first time.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, did you like it?
It was kind of fun. And to go places like that I haven't been and haven't seen.
Sure. Well, that's what the original Odysseus did too, right? He was
Amazed.
A traveler, an adventurer. So yeah, kind of living
right.
up to your name.
Yeah.
Good to talk to you, Odysseus. Odysseus Tafuna is a 10-year-old fifth grader from Ka'ava Elementary. He and classmate Ha'aheo Carter captured first place at the district level with Child Labor in China in the youth exhibit category for fourth and fifth graders as part of the annual History Day competition. The pair also won the Associated Chinese University Women Award for Chinese or Chinese American History. And you can find out more about them and about History Day at hpr2.org.
Thank you. crime of being a worker.
Congress starts to restrict this migration and make it illegal, creating this status of illegality for people who are doing the same thing that they've been doing for many generations.
How the idea of illegality clouds our ability to understand the immigration problem in America. Who is a criminal and who is an immigrant? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
HPR's base of support continues to grow thanks to the enthusiastic response to our Plus One new member program. Thanks to Kevin Herring and your Plus One, Jill Haswagawa, Heather Bolin and your Plus One, Sean Bolin, and Stephanie Larman and your Plus One, Allison William Chung, for participating in the Plus One campaign. You can visit hawaiipublicradio.org/plusone to find out more or call the membership team at 955-8821 during regular business hours. Art and politics converged last year to honor the memory of Dan Inouye and Patsy Mink, but this year the bill to create the art and the money to do it got a bit of tweaking, and there are still the questions of what the art should look like and where both pieces should go. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the details in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Hi, Beth Ann.
This art has a pretty big price tag of $500,000 for both pieces.
Yeah, that is something that lawmakers, however, feel is worthwhile. And there's some question as to exactly how the money's going to play out. The latest news is that it seems like they may have settled on a bronze statue to honor Congressman Mink. And the price range seems to be about $250,000, give or take a few dollars here. If that does go through, possibly it could be placed at the Hawaii State Library. That's something that the Mink family has requested. The Inouye statue, or artwork rather, is more vague. We're not quite sure what's going to happen there, because the family has gotten involved and said, you know, let's first of all decide where we're going to put it. Sounds like it's going to go at the Daniel K. Inouye Center at UH Manoa, which is planned, something that already has about $12 million going to it.
There's also some discussion about what that artwork should be. The family is sort of looking at something maybe a little bit more abstract. Someone says, no, maybe it needs to be something that's more, you know, a concrete image. I don't mean made out of concrete, but something that is easily discerned as being the senator. But how do we, you know, negotiate these ways of who is going to get more weight in this?
Well, they're trying to be as fair as possible, and with Senator Inouye, you're absolutely right. The family said, you know, we want to allow for a variety of proposals. They could be abstract. Most of us, when we think of a statue or something to honor someone, we think of the Queen Liliuokalani statue that's at the Capitol, for example.
Yeah, a representation of the person, right?
Right. But think of the Father Damien statue, which is on the other end of the Capitol. It's him, but it's very much a I'm not an artist here. We'll have to check with Noe Tanigawa on how to describe that statue, but it certainly is a more abstract depiction of Father Damien, now a saint. So the Inouye family wants to be flexible in that regard. It may be a statue. It may be a landscape. They're not quite sure. They're still working on that. The trick is to integrate it with the center planned at UH.
Looking at what that does for someone when they see a piece of art, I mean, art is so evocative, and, you know, it can cause you to remember things a little bit better because you have a picture in your mind of it. I mean, in part, that's what's behind having these pieces of art, isn't it?
Very much so. Mark Takei, the state representative, who, by the way, is running for Congress as a Democrat this year, he says, you know, I never met Queen Liliuokalani. I never met Father Damien. But when I see their statues, or when other people see their statues, you have a connection to them. There's a sense that they must have been a very important person that had a big impact. And for Takei, who introduced the bill, he says, that's the way a lot of people feel about Dan Inouye and Patsy Mink. They may be gone, but for future generations, if you have this artwork to honor them, hopefully that will remind people of their legacy and their contributions.
And be able to open up a conversation, perhaps, with a lot of kids.
Exactly.
Thanks, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
tonight at 5. Bethann, you'll be bringing us Town Square and a medical issue that is dividing the senior provider community. Is that right?
Well, it's more of who pays for it that has divided the community. This came through this last session, and there was some controversy surrounding Kapuna Care funds and whether or not they should be, you know, extended to Medicaid beneficiaries, because that's another separate pool of money. And this was a rather ugly fight. The question is, where do we go from here with all this? Because certainly nobody disagrees that seniors who need to have services, well, just need to have them.
But you're saying that this division is one where compromise is difficult or unlikely at this point?
Well, the question is, how do we go forward with it? And we're going to have different perspectives around the table. ARP's Director Barbara Kim Stanton will be here, Howard Garville, President of Child and Family Service, Wes Lum, the Director of the Executive Office on Aging, also Representative Della Albalotti. Different perspectives on how we go forward with changes that have happened in this last session, and how you can knit together a community that really at its heart wants to see good things happen for the senior community.
So there's certainly motivation toward coming up with a kind of shared solution to all this.
Well, I mean, they have a solution. De facto, what happened during the session has said this is the way we're going to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
But because there was such a divisive perspective in there, that's really becoming the heart of it, of how do we take this community that's sort of been cleaved and say, you know, we all have good things at heart, as many of them have said, but really looking at the money part of it, because when it comes down to rubber meeting the road, it's that pool of money, and that's still causing some divisiveness in it. Meanwhile, I don't think most seniors care where it's coming from as long as they get those services they need.
I'm sure, yeah. And people get a chance, as always, to call in and ask.
Absolutely. I mean, we're not going to rehash everything that happened over the last session, but to really look at how we go forward, because it's different on Oahu than it is within the other counties, and what those differences look like, and really what these organizations have to say.
Well, that's tonight at 5 on Town Square. Thanks, Bethann.
If you use a key to turn on your form of transportation, the fact that this week is Bike to Work Week nationally may have escaped you entirely, or maybe it even refocused your attention on your bike, you know, that thing that may be sitting in your garage. Commuters who routinely choose the two-wheelers hope that they'll have more riders join them tomorrow on Bike to Work Day in Hawaii. How much of that will affect bike policy in Hawaii, safety, and a change of behavior is on the mind of avid cyclist Meredith Spiker, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've talked about bike paths. We've talked about complete streets. We've talked about the sort of the journey from just the idea that we should have networked bike paths, which was a big thing even in the 90s when there was the plan, and now looking at how complete streets is being rolled out. Is this really been a journey that where we can see some quantifiable difference in how we look at people who are on a two-wheel version of transportation as opposed to the one with the four tires?
I think so. I think there's been a nice change recently. We see with the complete streets that we're starting to implement some of those ideas. And complete streets is really the idea that we're looking at people in transportation and not just the vehicle. So you're looking at pedestrians, you're looking at cyclists, you're looking at just a whole range of multimodal approaches, so the bus as well. And with this new law in place, we've really started to see some changes. And I think we still have the bike plan, and when we look at what the city and county of Honolulu is doing right now, they're doing their repavement plan, and they're looking at opportunities where they can bring in bike lanes. They're looking at opportunities for things like a separated bike path or a cycle track, where you really will have a more integrated system that's safe for people on bikes, keeps them off the sidewalk, gives them an actual space to safely transport themselves. And I think the big difference is switching away from only looking at cyclists for recreation and sport, but for a means of getting around town, getting to work and commuting. And so a day like Bike to Work Day is great to remind people that this is an option, and I think it's a growing movement.
Taking a look at how those spaces are going to be developed, that impact on behavior is really what you're talking about, not just having the stuff, but having people change their mindsets and understand that, you know, bikes have every right to be on the road, but they have to be responsible too. Everybody has to know the rules, and everybody has to be responsible and know that cars aren't the only way to get to where you need to go.
Absolutely.
So with Bike to Work Day, mm-hmm. which is tomorrow, is there any anticipation of how many more people may be joining, those of you who do it all the time?
That's a good question. We hope that there will be more people on the road. So all you drivers out there, please keep an
Heads
eye
up.
Out. and it's also just to bring awareness. The city also has a fun day on Sunday, Bike to the Zoo Day. So all of you parents and kids out there, you can actually get in free on Sunday if you ride your bike to the zoo.
Part of this starts early. There are some kids who brave it out there and they ride their bikes to school. Other parents who ride with them when they ride to school, drop them off and turn around, come back, and then maybe continue on to work, or maybe have to take a car because work is far away. We still live in a place where you have to travel a lot of miles, and biking to work is not appropriate for everyone. Your point seems to be that if it can be appropriate for you, why not consider this as well as the convenience of stepping into your car?
Yes, and another thing to keep in mind is you can bike part of the way. You could take the bus, you can put your bicycle on the bus, you could drive part way and ride your bike. So there's different opportunities like that. And with students getting to school, there is the Safe Routes to School initiative, which is both a federal, a state, and a local initiative. So it's the exciting part about that is we do have a for the counties and the city and county, we have a new program for Safe Routes to School. So fines will go towards funding this operation. And so we should see increased focus on those safe routes to school. So kids can ride their bikes, they can walk to school. You can have something like a school bus, a mobile school bus, where you have a parent or an adult with the kids, and you go in a group and you can safely ride your bike or walk to school. So initiatives like that are great to encourage the younger generation to stay on their bikes and to be active. And it's also good for your brain and getting into school and getting your blood flowing. So,
because most of us, start off with bikes of some sort, some mm-hmm. little trike or something, and then we slowly grow away from that unless there's a concerted effort to stay with it. When you look at Hawaii island-wide and statewide, any place where you think is particularly bike-friendly that you would just say to parents or to people who love to be on their bike, yeah, this is a great place to go?
There's a lot of exciting things happening in Kauai. There's the new coastal path that goes quite a ways, and they also have been successful recently in getting some funds for the Safe Routes to School program, so looking at safe ways for kids to get to the schools. And there's a real focus on getting people out. So I think if it's a great example, and I hope that the rest of the islands will be able to follow suit and implement to the extent that they have been able to.
Meanwhile, as we're looking toward tomorrow and the weekend, any particular routes that you think are going to be more used than others to really give a true heads up and not just say, hey, it's happening, but watch out on these roads?
Any roads that do have a bike lane are usually ones that will be used more. One exciting thing that will be coming up is a separated cycle track on King Street. So that will be in the future, but that one of the things that the city and others are looking at are routes that would be more easier for cyclists to use. So you don't necessarily have to have the roads that is heavily commuted by cars.
So you not necessarily main drags, but other routes that may be just as effective but a little bit more friendly to bikes.
Yes, that can get you there safely and efficiently.
And Meredith, since we don't have those for tomorrow or for Sunday, any places in particular that you'd like folks to pay a little bit more attention to if they're going to be traveling on those streets?
That's a good question. I would say just to keep a good eye out.
On all the main arteries.
On all the main arteries, yes.
Well, we'll see what happens tomorrow and keeping an eye out as we come in, although some of us who come in very, very early probably won't be seeing a lot of those bikers. Thanks so much for coming in, or cyclists, I should say. Meredith Spiker is a planner for the National Park Service Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program. She's the one-person field office for Hawaii and provides technical assistance for community-led projects that focus on conservation or recreation. Since 2007, she's been working on bicycle and pedestrian issues and is working with Cycle on Hawaii on Cyclovia, or open street events, safe routes to school support, and complete streets. Bike to Work Day is tomorrow. More about it is on HPR2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the exceptional checking account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we focused on a unique tree found in Hawaii. It's known scientifically as Eucalyptus deglupta. These trees have multi-hued rainbow-colored bark, and if you've seen one, you know it. It happens as their outermost bark layers peel away at certain times of the year. The shedding reveals fresh green bark that later matures into shades of blue and purple, yellow, orange, and maroon, all of them together. The final result looks like a mixture of all the colors, and it's what gives the trees their rainbow-like quality. Some people know this tree by its common nickname, the rainbow eucalyptus. You may know it by the name we asked you for today, the Mindanao gum. It's 8:45, and that's the answer to today's quiz. If you have an idea to share, send your backyard quiz to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Jennifer Rose from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
When you combine musical training with military discipline and dedication, you get some remarkable results. At its best, music is a world where nothing is allowed to compromise quality, and it deserves nothing less than that degree of focus. Because all branches of the service are represented in Hawaii, we have an unusually rich crop of skilled young musicians here among us, and that makes the annual Hawaii Joint Military Service Band Concert into an opportunity to hear what a large group of highly trained young musicians can do. It's a free show Saturday at the Hawaii Theater, and Captain Haley Armstrong, commander of the Air Force Band of the Pacific, is on hand to tell us about it. Good morning, Haley. Oh. Thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you. How many musicians have you got overall in this show?
For this event, we're actually using almost 60 musicians either on stage or behind the scenes, and it's just going to be a huge military appreciation moment.
When you hear the massed sound of that many musicians, I mean, it's a challenge to get it to sound good, but when it does, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Well, we're so lucky because our musicians are, you know, top notch. And it's the trick of getting us all together into the same place. But when we actually have that moment and you see all the different uniforms and all the different common ground that music brings together, and then being able to represent the military on that level, it's just, it's magic.
And that's exactly what music is. You know, that's why people turn to music at so many occasions, because it doesn't work unless it works with people together, yeah?
It really is. And the fun part is, with all of us, we serve the Pacific region, and there's a lot of international communities, and so we can use music, you know, to combine those internations and those people as well. And so it's just amazing what power music can have.
You know, Haley, when I first discovered military musicians' culture, it just made so much sense to me, in the sense of what music, the kind of thing that you need to bring to your music. Any kind of musician needs to be dedicated that way.
I think it. Most people don't realize that it would be a good fit, but we are trained when we get to the level that we're at. We're so dedicated to our skill that things like basic training, because we're all fully trained military members.
Yeah.
We do deploy. We go through all the regiments, but we already have that commitment, and we already have that teamwork that being a musician and playing in a musical ensemble has given us. So it is a good fit, even though most people don't think about it working together. It seems to work out in the end.
A lot of you folks are going to go on and continue as musicians throughout their lives, but even if you don't, even if you weren't to do that, what do you think you would have gotten out of this experience?
Well, for me, it's just been a chance to take my passion, which was been music all my life, and teaching and education, and then add service to that. And it's just being able to play music that has such purpose and has such meaning. When you're playing the national anthem for retired veterans, or when you're playing a different country's national anthem and honoring them and showing them America, it's just amazing to get to actually have that sort of impact. And so whether it's 1 year or, you know, 20, which is always the dream for a lot of our musicians, is to do the full 20 tour. And whether it's a little time or a lot, it's that service and that impact that you just can't do anywhere else.
That's a good point, because when you attach content to a piece of music, this is about, you know, when it's about something and everybody knows what it's about, it really does, it really helps get through to people.
It really changes the way you kind of interpret, whether it's history or meaning. This concert, we're featuring our heroes of the military, including, it's the 150th anniversary of the Arlington National Cemetery. And so we're going to spend some time talking about that. And we're spend some time, it's the 200th anniversary of the writing of the poem that is the Star-Spangled Banner. And so there's a lot of momentous things happening. And we're going to tell those stories through music. We've got concert band, jazz band, rock band. And then the main overall thing that we want to do is to thank this community, because these people are so supportive of our military. And so this free concert is a way for us to kind of give back a little bit and to share some of these stories and this history and, yeah, be a part of this wonderful community.
A lot of the events that you play for are community events of one kind or another, the ceremonial, but they can even be, it can even be sort of a community party, can't it?
It really can. You know, so many Americans, only less than 1% have served in our military, but everyone knows about it and wants to know about it. And so our military bands are a way for us to actually show people what we're doing and tell the stories of our airmen and our soldiers that are fighting in our wars and taking care of all of that. And so we get to share these stories with them and kind of let them inside our world, which is very closed off and gated normally. And so it's a chance for us to, you know, share some of that and let them know what we're up to.
You're a conductor now. You started as a trumpeter.
Mm-hmm.
How long of a journey has that been?
Oh, my goodness. I started playing trumpet at 11,
uh-huh.
Became a music teacher, loved teaching those young children, middle school, high school. Got into the military through the National Guard, actually. I was a part-timer.
Uh-huh.
And then went all the way to get my doctorate in conducting in order to be an active duty conductor at this point. So we have very skilled musicians. We'll have airmen with master's degrees. It takes a lot of dedication, but it's just that love of music. And I don't know what I would do without it, but I also don't know what I would do without serving my country. So it fits well for me.
And you're on the move throughout the Pacific, because your band, the Air Force band's mandate is you're the band of the Pacific. Mm-hmm. So that means some of your troops are in Japan and
yes.
some are here?
Yes, actually, I am based out of Japan with the larger part of my unit, and then I have 15 here. And so for me, coming back to Hawaii and coming back into the U.S., you know, I only get to do it every couple of months, and I know that my guys are being taken care of because of this community, and I know that the support that, you know, this island shows our military is helping when I can't be here. And then my folks, we travel to any of the nations in the Pacific, any of the regions for either military or embassy support. So it's nice to have a home to come back to.
With this event, you're merging your personnel with, what, four other branches of service?
Yes, we're pulling out all the stops. So we've got our Air Force personnel, and then we have a lot from the Navy band, the Marine band, the active duty Army band, and then also there's an Army Guard band on the island who's going to come and work with us as well. So we went and found anybody who was serving full on a military uniform, and so we're going to put it all together on Saturday.
What kind of material? You said some of the songs are about the Arlington anniversary.
Yes, we're dedicating and celebrating our heroes through some great classic works. Summon the Heroes by John Williams, who is actually an Air Force member. He spent 2 years in the Air Force before becoming the famous movie icon.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But we're also doing a lot of classic concert works. But then we're playing two jazz band songs to kind of focus on World War II. And then we also have our rock band, which is our component that we use a lot in today's wars when we're deployed and we're out doing music in the deployed environment. So you're going to see everything from Civil War fantasy up until some very modern classics that you'd hear on the radio.
Because I know the first time I heard some of you guys play, you know, a Chaka Khan tune, a Led Zeppelin tune, and really nail it. It's the versatility is one of the things that strikes me. Yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Every day I am just so amazed at what our musicians can produce, because you go from having to play a disco medley combined with a Japanese concert band, followed by a full-on ceremony for a four-star general with honors and ruffles and everything in between. So it keeps us entertained.
It's a pretty good life, huh?
It is. I cannot complain.
Well, Captain, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having us, and we hope to see people out on Saturday. Free concert, 6 p.m. Yeah. Hawaii Theater. It'd be fantastic.
What's not to like, right? Captain Haley Armstrong is the commander of the Air Force Band of the Pacific, which will be performing as part of the 29th Annual Hawaii Joint Military Service Band Concert at the Hawaii Theater Saturday at 6 p.m. The free show features musicians from the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Army National Guard bands stationed here in Hawaii. And the theme of this year's concert recognizes the 150th anniversary of Arlington Cemetery and includes other patriotic and classical favorites. Details are at hpr2.org.
Cousins Patrick Landeza and Ian O'Sullivan share an evening of music and melee as they team up musically for the first time and debut their unique blend of classical and Hawaiian guitar. They will be joined by special guest guitarist Fia Leoso and bassist Chris Lau. That's Friday, May 23rd at 7:30. Tickets at 955-8821 or online at hprtickets.org.
Usually our guests are older than 10 years old, and today we had fifth grader Odysseus Tafuna on the show talking about his research that he did about child labor in China. And looking at the layers and the texture of his conversation, although he was fairly brief in some of his comments, still, Chris, I mean, the fact that he could see that there were lots of different layers to this, it wasn't simply a case of, well, don't buy the stuff.
Exactly, and you know, he had a very there's a clarity to the young mind when they take on an issue like this. They sort of go right to the things that matter, because they see things, you know, in a very, very sort of clear manner. I was very impressed with him.
And how he was able to personalize it and yet maintain some distance from it, too. always great when we get to have kids here in the studio, particularly when they've done such interesting projects.
I think part of it was him saying, you know, that could be me.
Well, right, and that's part of what I think he said drew him to it in the first place. But being able to extend our vision to other issues where that could be me, and tagging it back to the issue of the racist study.
Exactly.
That could be all of us. That's going to do it for us for this Thursday morning on tomorrow's agenda. Sustainability at UC Berkeley. We're going to talk with Professor Tyrone Hayes.
And we'll preview a one-man show about Mark Twain in Hawaii.
You can talk back to your radio anytime you like. You can find us and each other on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. That would be me. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation. And I'll see you later.